This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 43 was recorded on December 15th, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Julian Brigden of MI2 gave us one of our most popular interviews ever back in May, and he's back with us again as today's featured interview guest. We'll discuss all things macro, from inflation to treasury yields to the U.S. dollar and much more. The full-color book of graphs and charts that Julian prepared for his interview in May was our most popular download ever, and he's done it again with another book of graphs and charts. I strongly encourage you to take a minute to download the chart book before the interview begins, as we'll be referring to it throughout our discussion. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your research roundup email. For those of you who have yet to register, Aaron will tell you how to get the download before the interview begins. But wait, there's more. As regular listeners know, I've really been looking forward to getting an update from Real Vision founder Raoul Paul on his views on treasury yields and the duration risk trade that we discussed at length in his feature interview several weeks ago. So Aaron has arranged for Raoul to make a cameo appearance in today's show after the feature interview with Julian Brigden.
And I'm Aaron Chen. Before we get to equities, let's start with the Fed's decision to hike policy interest rates by 25 basis points on Wednesday. Now, markets responded with a spike in the dollar index to cycle highs and sharp sell-offs in everything from stocks to crude oil. But what doesn't seem to add up here is that this rate hike should have already been priced in, quote-unquote, considering that almost every single prominent analyst was predicting it. So, Eric, what's going on here?
Well, I don't think it's the rate hike. As you say, the rate hike was priced in. Everybody knew it was coming. What very, very few people saw coming was the update to the dot plot, which now says that the Fed is forecasting 3 rate hikes in 2017 instead of 2 previously. So the sentiment that this would be the last hike and that the rate normalization cycle was a fantasy that was not really going to continue, that seems to be fading in favor of the view that, hey, you know, Trump policies are changing the landscape, inflation is going to be coming back, therefore the Fed is going to have to continue the rate normalization process, and of course that affects everything. Now, of course, everybody is conveniently forgetting the fact that it is still impossible to truly normalize rates, you know, all the way back to a 6% treasury yield. It would be categorically impossible for the government to continue operating because it couldn't possibly afford its debt service if we truly normalized rates. But at least moving back in the right direction is something that the mainstream has begun to catch hold of. I would caution, though, you know, let's remember, 1 year ago today, the Fed was predicting 4 rate hikes in 2016. We only got a grand total of 1, and that came in mid-December. So how important is it that they're forecasting 3 in 2017? Probably not very, but it's definitely impacting the way people are viewing the market.
So, Eric, you asked me to put the presidential election back on the agenda. Dude, haven't you heard it's over? Donald Trump won, so why do you want to bring it up again? What's on your mind?
Well, remember my tweet from Election Day morning when I said this thing ain't over until it's over. And folks, it ain't over yet. The way this works is these people called electors take the popular vote, or rather the Electoral College system vote, and cast the electoral votes on December 19th. That's this coming Monday. We have all sorts of things going on. Hollywood celebrities have produced a video encouraging the electors to defect and not vote for Donald Trump because they just think that it's an unthinkable world under Donald Trump. Meanwhile, you've got Larry Lessig, a Harvard University professor, offering free legal advice, telling the electors that in many states it is legal for them to ignore the will of the people and vote differently than what they're supposed to vote based on how the election went. And meanwhile, Zero Hedge reported this morning that the electors are actually receiving death threats if they vote for Donald Trump. So my point is, this is not a prediction. This is definitely an outlier. But if ever there was a presidential election where absolutely anything could happen, this is it. And the propaganda that's being slung is this evidence-free report from the CIA supposedly saying that evil Russians hacked the election, and therefore the electors should ignore the popular vote, which may not have been privy to the latest intelligence, and perhaps they should declare this to be a situation where Donald Trump is unfit because he's actually a secret Russian spy. And the electors do have the ability to essentially throw the election to the House of Representatives. If the vote does not happen in favor of Donald Trump, as everyone expected, they can overturn it and basically allow the House of Representatives to choose the next president. That would be quite an unprecedented thing. And again, it's not my prediction. I'm just saying this thing ain't over till it's over. All it takes is 37 of these 500 or so electors to defect and not vote for Donald Trump like they're supposed to, and the election goes to the House of Representatives.
The stock market broke out to a new all-time high of 2273 on E-mini S&P futures earlier this week, but it's been selling off in the wake of the Fed's rate hike and the forecast of three more hikes coming in 2017. Eric, what's your take on equities here?
I still don't have any strong view on the fundamentals here. I'm on the sidelines because I think there have been good arguments made on both sides. And I don't think that the real what does the Trump presidency mean, you know, narrative has really been formed yet. So I'm waiting to see. If you want to know what the catalyst is that would bring about an outright crash, that situation, and again, it is an outlier, it's not a prediction, but if the election were thrown back to the House of Representatives and nobody knows who's going to be the next president, that would definitely cause market havoc. Again, not a prediction, just an outlier.
The U.S. dollar index broke out to a new cycle high above 103 in reaction to the FOMC announcement. So what's next for the dollar?
Well, I sure wish that I had bought more. I am long dollar index futures ever since 97.70 or so, after it broke out above 97.5. And I wish that I had bought more. I was waiting for a dip. And then, of course, the unexpected dot plot update. It's not the rate hike that has caused this big spike up in the dollar index. It's the dot plot. So far, Thursday's high print was 103.53. We're looking at 103.14. I wish that I had bought more on a 100 handle yesterday when I had the chance, but I didn't. The position that I do have on is, of course, performing very well. And I think that we're headed much higher from here. Again, if there were an upset and this Electoral College thing on Monday were to see a wrinkle, and especially if they threw the election back to the House of Representatives, that could cause a huge downside risk for the dollar index due to uncertainty. But short of that, I think we're headed much higher. I would say, though, that, you know, it's kind of overdone here. We're seeing a big knee-jerk reaction to the FOMC, and probably, you know, if history is any indicator, we'll give back about half of that before the rally resumes again in earnest. So I wouldn't be rushing to add more to the position here. I'll be looking for a pullback. If we get back down to 101 or so, I'll definitely be looking to add to my long position.
Well, speaking of knee-jerk reactions, crude oil has been on a roller coaster ride this week. So what's going on with the oil market?
Well, there was a combination of the non-OPEC countries meeting over the weekend and agreeing to go ahead and do what everybody thought they were going to do, which is to supposedly curtail their production. Now, this is a small enough cut that there's room for everybody to cheat. There's a lot of speculation as to whether anybody is going to do it. As far as I'm concerned, it's for public consumption. It's in name only. Whether or not anybody actually cuts production remains to be seen. So that was one half of it. Probably the other big half was the unexpected statement from Saudi Arabia over the weekend that they might, I emphasize might, cut production even more than agreed. They didn't say how much more than agreed. And that, were these things significant? Of course they were significant. Did they justify the gap up open by more than a dollar on Sunday evening's open? In my opinion, no. Did they justify another dollar to the upside in the first minute of trading after Sunday evening's open into thin liquidity? In my opinion, no, but it happened anyway. Did it justify still another dollar on top of that, all the way to more than $3 of upside in the next hour? So the first hour of trading on Sunday were $3 up against Friday's close. No, it was ridiculous, and it's no surprise at all that that resulted in a blow-off hysteria top. 54.51 was the high print. That was within the first hour of trading on Sunday's thin liquidity session. And, of course, I knew it was not going to last. I used that opportunity because backwardation became very apparent in the belly of the curve, and I used that opportunity to put on another curve steepener trade, basically betting that the backwardation that existed in the second half of 2017 is going to go away before those contracts expire. Of course, just as I expected, it mean reverted. I'm already up very nicely on the curve steepener trade. So, I love it when this kind of thing happens, but it didn't make any sense. Inventory, very confusing again this week. 2.5 million barrel drawdown on nationwide inventories. And that's in the wake of API, which is the private American Petroleum Institute, predicting a 5 million barrel build in inventory. Now, everybody's ridiculing API. Those stupid, dumb idiots don't get it. Their prediction was all wrong. Remember, API is not a prediction of what EIA is going to do. API is its own independently sourced data. And it's true that it is voluntarily submitted, whereas EIA is based on compulsory reporting. That's the reason a lot of people put more credence in the EIA numbers. But I question who's actually getting it right, because the EIA numbers don't make sense lately. We talked about this last week. Cushing, Oklahoma, 1.2 million barrel build in the EIA data. So why is it that if Cushing is building both this week and last week, that nationwide numbers are drawing down both this week and last week? Most of it, if you look at the breakdown, appears to be on the West Coast, because it's not Pad 3, it's not the Gulf Coast where these drawdowns are happening. Why would the West Coast suddenly be drawing down in inventory? I can't come up with a reason for that. Finished products were kind of a mixed bag, 497,000 barrel build on gasoline inventories against a 262,000 barrel drawdown in distillate inventories. So that's, almost balancing each other out. The thing I keep seeing is what is going on that API's numbers and what you would expect from the Cushing numbers is that we'd be seeing builds in nationwide inventory, but the last 2 weeks in a row, EIA has reported drawdown. So I thought, Art Berman knows everything. I'll email Art and ask him what's going on. Before I got a chance to do so, I got an email from Art saying, Eric, what the hell is going on here? It seems like API's numbers don't jibe with EIA, and the national numbers don't jibe with Cushing. It doesn't make sense. What do you make of this? So neither Art or I can figure out what's going on, but I would say the EIA numbers are not really consistent. They don't make sense to me, and I'm inclined to put more credence in the API number, which was a 5 million barrel build on inventory last week. So nobody seems to be noticing amid all of this. You know, as we look at this big spike up in prices, it all happened as a result of this production cut talk. This is all promises about what people are supposed to be doing in the future. What's happening in the present? Well, Saudi Arabia just announced all-time record high production. Iraq's loading schedule, that's the schedule of when they're going to load ships with exported oil that's going to be shipped out in January, that shows a 7% increase in exports in January when they're supposedly going to be cutting because of this agreement. So what they're saying and what they're doing don't match, but the market is paying attention to the rhetoric that's coming out of the oil ministers. You know, I listen to this stuff and I think the only people dumb enough to believe this would be, the whole oil market, because they do believe it, and I just can't believe it.
So Eric, you've been predicting that the widely anticipated Fed rate hike would hammer gold prices lower, and well, that's exactly what happened. With gold trading as low as 1124 late this morning and closing around 1130. But you've also suggested that this rate hike induced weakness in gold could mark a cycle low and thus a great buying opportunity. So did you buy the dip in gold?
No, I didn't buy the dip, and of course, what we saw is exactly what's happened. The thing is, I don't know if it's over yet, and the reason I say that is the dot plot update. If people are expecting the rate normalization process to continue, for Treasury yields to continue to move higher over the next year, and again, the fact that I'm skeptical that they're going to do that and actually follow through on it doesn't matter. It's what the market expects to happen, not what's really going to happen, that's going to drive prices. And that's bearish for gold. You know, gold competes with treasuries. Most people think that they are equally safe, even though I don't personally agree. A lot of investors see treasuries as a risk-free asset, just like gold. And as treasuries continue to produce higher and higher yields, that's bad news for the gold market. So I'm not sure this is over yet. I'm going to definitely be asking Julian Brigden this question in today's feature interview. I want to get his take because he was recommending gold when we interviewed him last time. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm still on the sidelines. I'm wait-and-see mode.
And lastly, 10-year Treasury yields are breaking out big time, trading above 2.60 earlier today and closing at 2.60 as of Thursday's close. So what's going on with bond yields here?
Well, definitely the extra strength in bond yields is a reaction to the FOMC. It's because of the dot plot and the expectation of more rate hikes occurring in 2017. Of course, you know, the 10-year is going to react to short-term rates, as there's an expectation that more and more people are seeing the Jeff Gundlach view, that the 35-year bull market in bonds may be over and that we're headed towards higher interest rates. That's all fueling this. The question is, how much farther does it have to go? I'm going to save the meat of this for Julian Brigden because he's the guy who predicted all of this 6 months ago. He told us that we'd be back to inflation, and he told us that we'd be looking at higher bond yields, and that's exactly what's happened. I tend to put credence in the guy who got it right before it happened. So I want to find out what Julian has to say about this.
Well, on that note, let's move on to today's feature interview with MI2 founder Julian Brigden. As Eric mentioned earlier, you're definitely going to want the chart book for this interview. Registered users will find the download link in their Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, it's free and only takes a minute. Just go to www.macrovoices.com, click the red Subscribe for Free button at the top right side of the page, then click the Register Your Free Macro Voices Account button near the bottom of the next page. Once you're registered and logged in, click the Research Library button on the black menu bar, then click Guest Publications. That will take you up to a page where you can download today's chart book, as well as other presentations from all our past Macro Voices guests, including Julian Brigden's first chart book from back in May.
Folks, anybody can sound good on a podcast show. All you have to do is confidently pontificate about what's driving the market and use the right terminology to express your views, regardless of whether they turn out to be right or wrong. But if you want to know who the one guy is on this program who really nailed it and whose predictions on this show came true in spades in the months that followed his interview here, it's Julian Brigden. So for those of you guys who are really serious about this stuff, I encourage you to go back and listen to Julian's first interview from May 27th and review his first chart book. You can still find that on our homepage at macrovoices.com, and Aaron just told you how to get the chart book. Look at what Julian predicted back then, and remember how he was practically laughed out of the room by most of his peers for predicting a trend change from disinflation to inflation. And then check out how all of his other predictions have worked out. Bottom line, when Julian Brigden talks, I pay close attention, and I encourage you to as well.
Okay, and without further ado, let's get to the interview, which is coming up next, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Macro Intelligence 2 Partners founder Julian Brigden. And Julian, I want to start by congratulating you. I think of all of the interviews that we've done, your predictions from the interview we did back on May 27th have probably come true more than almost any other guest that we've spoken to. So congratulations on that, and thanks for coming back.
Well, thank you, Chris. I mean, better, as I always like to say, better to be lucky than smart. But I do find it quite interesting that, you know, we've managed to get it wrong, and yet these central banks just seem to have been floundering and looking in the other direction. So, I mean, it's, you know, back when we chatted to you guys in May, we just sort of presented this view where we said, you know, you have an R view, and I've started off the slide presentation with the dollar chart, and because I just think this to me is the crux of what dictates basically the cycle in financial markets. So it's the kind of the waxing and waning of that dollar, which causes, you know, commodity prices and a lot of other prices to move. So when the dollar is falling, it's broadly inflationary. So if you kind of look at that first cycle, you can't see it was falling very, very high levels because it was in it sort of masked by Bretton Woods, the fixed exchange rate mechanism in the late 60s into the 70s. But essentially, the dollar was falling in value as we were printing money for Vietnam. We were pumping up commodity prices in Latin America in particular. The dollar hits the low, Paul Volcker comes in where you need this policy response off that low level. And amazingly, that line on the bottom, even though, Eric, this is a inflation-adjusted trade-weighted index, so it's untradeable. That's actually a dead straight line. It's just uncanny. And then the dollar rallies again, and you know, around sort of 21%, we break the bubble in Latin America, and dollar goes up, you hit Plaza Accord. But you can see that we have this very sequence cycle, and it's just similar sort of amplitudes in terms of percentage changes. And so when we spoke to you guys back in May, we said, look, we've just seen another big rise in the dollar from 2011, but particularly of an accelerated manner from the middle of 2014. And we've broken the world again. The Fed has stepped back, but that's never to us the dollar high, because in that process of stepping back, and you can see it, we've done it now three times, you get this 21% odd rally, 25 or change or so, and then we pause. And it's because we have caused an emerging market crisis, and we certainly had one in 2015. It's not quite the same nature as the Latin American or Asian crisis of the past, because we didn't have pegged exchange rates, but they were ugly crises. This was an ugly crisis. So the dollar pauses. It naturally creates this reflationary cycle in emerging markets and commodities again. But because it is reflationary, eventually the Fed has to tighten again. And so, you know, this time they'd obviously, I think, massively overreacted to that dollar rally. It was a dollar rally that caused oil to fall again. And they said, oh, you know, oh my God, this is deflation. Well, falling oil prices, even in the US with a massive shale industry, isn't deflationary. It is transitory disinflation, because we measure pricing over a year-on-year basis, and it's ultimately stimulative. So, you know, we got ECB NERP and BOJ NERP, just massive, massive, massive overreaction to this, you know, transitory disinflationary and stimulative event. And so we had sort of, we're coming into the summer and we said, oh, they've overcooked this. They've really, really overstimulated. And there was lots of concern about the equity market. Could the equity market take the strain? But our focus was on the bond market. That's where we thought the biggest mispricing had been created. And our thought was that as the reflation started to move through into the real economy. So, you know, we saw the dollar pause in January. As soon as the dollar started to pause, oil prices, commodity prices, EM all ripped again. But it takes some time for that effect to feed through into the real economy. But our thought was that as it fed through into the real economy, you would get this cyclical rebound in growth and inflation. And that's what we were playing back in the summer. And the growth comes through because if you look at the chart that I've shown you here.
And I just want to insert for the benefit of our listeners who might have skipped ahead, Aaron did tell you where to get the chart book. We're talking now about the chart on page 2 of the chart book, and the instructions for the download were presented before the interview began. For those of you who fast-forwarded and skipped the instructions, go back now and that's where you'll find it. I'm sorry, please continue.
No problem. So if you look here, we've got a chart of showing wholesale sales, and you can see that obviously we had, in the US, we had built up this big shale industry. And it, you could argue in many respects that it was somewhat responsible for the outperformance of the US economy versus the European economy for much of the recovery we've seen since the GFC. It was this big burst of domestic investment related to shale. But you can see as soon as the dollar started to rally, and we've highlighted that in red, you burst that bubble. And all the data deteriorated in industries that were related to that, obviously petroleum, metals, and some of the other industries, which we haven't highlighted here. But you can see how it just whacks out. But the trouble is we measure, when we look at data, we typically look at the speed of data. We don't look at the level. So we don't talk about the level of GDP. We talk about the rate of change. We talk about quarter over quarter, year over year. And even something like ISM is ultimately a measurement of speed and not level. Hence, in 2009, at the depths of the GFC, you could get ISM manufacturing moving from sort of 33, I think was the low, up to almost 60. There was nothing really much better going on in the world. What had just happened is very simply, there was a base effect going on. The massive drawdown that we'd seen in ISM in 08 dropped out in 09 and the data reverted. And so essentially that's what we were playing for. And you can see it not only in the US, but if you look at the Next slide here, you'll see global trade. And you can see once again, dollar rallies, global trade gets crushed because it's very heavily emerging market and commodity related. And all of those are exceedingly dollar sensitive. The minute the dollar stops rallying in 2016, your global trade picks up. And we think that this global trade is coming through and will continue to push through into sometime in Q1, beginning of Q2. And so our basic case was, look, central banks overreacted to this collapse in oil prices led by a higher dollar. They pause the dollar as the Fed backs away from further rate hikes. You get this reflationary cycle. You get this pickup in global trade. And essentially, the sell-off in fixed income was got nothing to do really with Donald Trump per se. I think he acted as a clear accelerant, but it was already baked in the cake. And so now we're having to deal with better data, and we can see it now with everything from Chinese export data to some of the PMI data we're seeing here in the US. I mean, you only got to look at today's data. It was incredibly robust prints, a lot higher than people expected. And now in addition to that, we have to deal with inflation, because once again, if you look here, we've got a chart of US CPI, and you can see really a lot of the key components of inflation, the ones that we have to deal with on a daily basis, owner equivalent rent, service costs, medical, actually have hardly budged. In fact, very slightly increasing and steadily. What happened to headline inflation, it was dragged down by a massive fall in that energy component, once again caused by that massive rally in the dollar, which we've highlighted where the dollar peaked. And as soon as the dollar peaks, energy CPI comes back and it's dragging up headline CPI. So once again, going into the spring, we are still dealing with not only stronger growth, but higher inflation pressures. And we think they're going to print, some of these headline numbers are going to print some materially higher numbers. And it's not only headline inflation. So if you look at the next chart here, you'll see a wage cost model we've got. Now, Atlanta Fed is already printing close to 4%, and it's probably got a little bit more further to go. But average hourly earnings has not. It's still got a long way to go. We think this could be pushing up towards 3.5%. And given that the Fed, has only given us sort of 50 basis points of rate hikes, that suggests to us that they are woefully, woefully behind the curve. And this becomes, I think, a significant problem. And what I think is actually even more interesting, even than the US story, because we know that the US has had a stronger economy, is that you're actually starting to see inflationary pressures in areas of the world which are meant to be mired in deflation. So we've quoted here the comments from one of the Eurozone PMI numbers that came at surveys that just came out. And they are talking, if you look at the last sentence, they say manufacturing output price inflation is currently running at the highest level for 5 years, which is inevitably translating into higher consumer prices, which will inevitably translate into higher consumer prices in coming months. It's just not what the ECB is even contemplating. And, I have nothing but scathing comments to talk about the ECB when it comes to timing of rate policy responses. I think this is possibly one of the worst central banks out there. I mean, these are the guys who hiked in 2008 going into the worst downturn ever because oil prices were heading up to $150. And Trichet said, if we are not decisive, inflation may explode. He got it just 180 degrees wrong, because it actually imploded as the real economy imploded under the pressure of $150. And then in Draghi, beginning of this year, he said, we will not surrender to low inflation, was the exact quote. He is not going to have to. So if you look at the next slide, you'll see our model for headline CPI in Europe. And we think this is going to push materially, materially higher. And we've yet to see that full effect come through. And even in another part of the world where this is supposed to be a disinflationary force in the world, China, you can see here we're now starting to see a material acceleration in PPI. In fact, it was a big shock when PPI jumped up towards 1.2% last month, but we think this thing has got a lot further to go. So we continue to think that this pushes forward. And once again, you'll see a quote coming from one of the PMIs, this time saying, this is the Caijin Manufacturing PMI, and they said that the index tracking input and output prices rose at the fastest level in 5 years. Once again, this five-year thing pointing to further intensification of inflationary pressures. So we just see, Eric, this world where we've overcooked it. We push bond markets thanks to these asinine policies of the ECB and the BOJ, NERP, push bonds to absurd levels, distorting long-term valuations by quite considerable amounts. And now we have to deal with this base effect of rising inflation and rising yields, and rising growth. And to us, this is going to have a very material impact, and we're still working through that in terms of the bond market. So we started to see this correction in the bond market, but you can see here from this chart that when we look at treasuries, it still looks like we've got further to go. And I think we're starting to see that move, you know, in today's price action, or certainly after Yellen's message yesterday in that as well. And you're getting the next level of the sell-off, which we think can take 10-year Treasury yields up to just slightly above 3%. But that's even, and this is the point, that's even before we've even spent a red cent of Trump's fiscal spending package. This is just purely based on the existing economic dynamics, let alone some accelerative package.
Before we move on to the dollar, Julian, I'd like to ask you a few questions because my mind is just going a million miles a minute. First of all, it seems like you're really, you know, this rise of populism with Donald Trump and Brexit and everything else. Some people are saying that central banks are losing power. Is this the moment where, you know, they kind of lose control of the curve and even if they want to hold rates down, they can't anymore? Or are you saying they're going to change their mind and not want to hold them down anymore?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, this sort of losing of power. We wrote this piece to clients that are heading into the Jackson Hole meeting at the end of the summer. And we called it Jackson Hole from Heroes to Zeros. And essentially, we said that we thought that we'd hit this sort of cycle high in terms of the power of central bankers, not only because they've really failed to deliver benefits to the real broad economy, but also because they were just massively misreading the financial economy. And they were creating this bubble. And they were just getting, you know, delving further and further into the absurdities of deep academic thought, that they were becoming more and more divorced from the reality of the real world. So, you know, we had, going into Jackson Hole, we had the ECB going full-blown QE along with the BOJ and NERP. And we'd written extensively about how those policies in combination with each other were utterly ridiculous. You know, one is truly reflationary, QE, and the other one sends an utterly deflationary signal, NERP. And yet, you know, here you had a bunch of people who believe viscerally in the power of forward guidance, the sort of Captain Picard make it so type moment. And yet they were sending this conflicting signal. So, yes, I think we do believe that the peak has been achieved in terms of central bank omnipotence.
So that begs my next question, which is, if I look at your chart here on slide 13, you're expecting just current fundamentals, before we consider Donald Trump, to get us above 3% Treasury yields. Jeff Gundlach has said longer term maybe as high as 6%. And I can't help but just say, wait a minute, governments cannot operate, literally would go bankrupt at historically normal Treasury yields because of this massive debt burden that they've undertaken since the GFC. So what happens? Does that mean that we can't get to those yields, or we do get to those yields and there's a big collapse of the government? I mean, how does this play out?
No, I think, you know, there are times when you can go back and look at history. In fact, I was doing it sort of yesterday. And we were, you know, you can take CPI charts back on, you know, if you've got access to things like Bloomberg, but you can look on the Fed websites and the government websites and get these. And you can look at these periods where, you know, for much of the 60s, we had very, very low inflation, very, very low, very stable, very similar to now, actually. And yet there was no panic about, oh, my God, the sky's falling, we've got deflation. And then all of a sudden, we get into sort of 1965, we're starting to spend money in Vietnam, and lo and behold, big fiscal spending, you know, upruns this inflation cycle. But it is a process, if you look at it, Eric, of sort of two steps forward, one step back. And actually, in fact, we were doing some work internally with one of my quants, who's a mining specialist. He worked on, very cool, he was an explosive expert. But his mathematics is very good, because I guess you have to be pretty precise in that space. And we were looking at these cycles of inflation and how you almost have this sort of natural amplitude and it continues to sort of build. And it actually, you can be replicated by a lot of sort of fluid dynamic cycles. But the point is you see this initial pickup, there is a response, it pushes things down, but you never quite go to the low. And so to this sort of 6% argument, I would say, is it possible? Yeah, maybe over time. But I do think that the run up to 3, because essentially what I've been talking about is a cyclical story, all right, in many respects based upon base effects of the negative drop of oil feeding into the shale industry, feeding into global trade. As that just drops out, we see the pickup. But it is just a base effect cyclical story. And that will mostly peak, as I said, sometime in Q1. At that point, if we're hit 3% in 10-year treasury yields, we will also have to deal with the reality of a pretty significant tightening in financial conditions, fixed income being one element, the dollar, which we'll talk about in a second, being another one. And so I do expect then to see some sort of pause before we get the sugar high of the Donald Trump spending, which realistically won't kick in until end of Q3, beginning of Q4. And now at that point, maybe we see that next leg up. But I would agree with you. I don't think we can go back straight to 6%. I think if you go anywhere close to that, the world will just implode. But it doesn't mean, I think all we're doing at this point is just normalizing where we should be. So yeah, 3%, then back off a bit, let the dust settle, and let's see what comes through from Donald Trump's money.
And with the inflation talk that you're predicting, of course, you were predicting inflation back when we spoke in May. Everyone else seems to have caught up with you since then, and It's very popular now to predict inflation. But, the gold bugs would tell you that inflation is supposed to be super bullish for gold, and boy, that's not happening. So what's going on with gold? And also, I guess, there's a strong dollar argument should be negative for oil, but at the same time, inflation should be positive for oil. So gold and oil, what do you see happening as this forecast plays out?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you're dealing with commodities. And commodities they're very, very, very heavily correlated to what the dollar does. But within that sphere, there are lots of different commodities. You've got the softs, you've got, raw materials, and you've got precious metals. And precious metals to me are simply, and I think I said this back in May, are simply an anti-dollar trade. I think I showed you at the time a chart for silver. It's what we call a classic bubble. It had its blow-off highs in 2011. And if you look at that chart, take a long, long-term chart of silver, and you chart it against the dollar, it is essentially 100% inverse. It is just a high beta dollar trade. Unfortunately, people get viscerally attached to precious metals. I don't know whether it's that shiny element, which just causes people to just get irrational about it in many respects. But I think they're great trading vehicles. And I think I expressed at the time that we'd advocated buying it back at the beginning of January, silver. But it was a trade. And the problem is as the dollar starts to rise, particularly driven by higher yields, then something like precious metals does very badly. And I know I'm going to upset some of your listeners when I say I think that, we are probably heading back down, under 1,000, potentially on a nasty flush out, quite badly under 1,000 in gold. And silver will be pushing the mid to low 14s. So, that's the precious metal story. Oil, on the other hand, it's not necessarily just an anti-dollar trade. I mean, there is a demand supply cycle to this. There's an investment cycle that takes digging it out of the ground. So it is possible to have periods of strong oil in a rising dollar environment. So I think one has to take a step back and look at it. It's not, look, don't get me wrong, I'm not wildly bullish for oil. We were bullish back in March. We suggested buying it on a break of 30 with a sort of target of 45 to 50. And I think, if I want to be a cynic, I'd look at what the Saudis have done and say, this is basically allowing them to tee up for the sale of Saudi Aramco, which, if you want to be a altruistic and say, oh, this is about, you know, trying to relaunch the Saudi economy and invest, take that money and invest it in alternative forms of growth in Saudi. If you want to be a cynic like me, you'll say this is basically to allow the royal family to pad their wallet so that when the inevitable, let's not name it, hits the fan, okay, they've got plenty of cash sitting in Geneva so they can take, excuse me, so they can take the money out. But I think that there is a clear plan here from the Saudis to keep the oil price elevated into that Saudi Aramco sale next year. But the point is for your clients is you have to differentiate in commodities. There are different types of commodities. Precious metals to me, though, are 110% just an anti-dollar trade. And especially when rates are rising, don't want to own any of them.
One more inflation question before we move on to your dollar slides. You know, I have felt since the great financial crisis that basically what's propping up asset markets, particularly equities, is central bankers printing money in order to prop up asset markets. And I've thought to myself, what brings that to an end someday? And my contention is they don't stop until something forces their hand. So my question is the degree of inflation that you're predicting enough to force their hand to basically create a threat where they can't print more money because it would exacerbate or runaway inflation? Or do you not think we're looking at that much inflation at this point?
Well, I think it's all relative, right? I mean, you know, and by that I mean it's the relative pricing of inflation and rates relative to other asset prices. You know, so if you live in a world where your inflation is 10%, your rates are 12, then your other assets are priced accordingly. You know, we're living in a world where, you know, equity discount factors have just been amazing because rates have been so incredibly low. So it's not like we need to see inflation go back to 10. You know, rampant inflation would be 3.5, given where asset prices are. So I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, Raoul and I have ended up, who writes the Real Vision stuff and GMI, have ended up talking about at times is, you know, his sort of longer-term view, which is much more sort of bearish, and my sort of short-term views. And it's not that I necessarily radically disagree with Raoul. I don't. I think it's always been, to me, a question of how do we get to that potential tipping point? And I think you raise a very good point. You know, lots of people have been saying, look, you know, we get to a point where the central banks just are increasingly ineffective and equity markets roll over. And my point was, yeah, but how do we get there? Do we get there because we have economic weakness? And to me, that was just not going to be the case, because if you've got economic weakness, they just keep giving you more and more crack cocaine in the form of QE or, you know, whatever latest iteration, or buying stocks if they had to. The problem, fundamentally, the structurally dangerous point actually arrives where I think we could be sometime next year. And that is that you actually have strength coming through and you do have that inflation story coming through. And let's say that we get to a point where this backup and tightening of financial conditions causes the equity market to tip over, because I think there are many similarities to the cycle of falling oil prices, falling headline inflation, wobbly growth, and then a sort of basing of oil prices and a move higher that we saw in 1985 into 1987 crash, and from 1996 into the 2000 crash. So let's imagine that we're at that point sometime next year, that we've seen growth rebound, the bond market and inflation, the bond market's wobbled badly, yields have backed up, but initially the equity market takes it as a positive because it's backed up by this cyclical rebound in growth, which is what you saw in 1987 and what you saw from basically sort of 1998 into 2000. And we're seeing now in this speed of data improvement. But then you get to a point where, having taken money out of the bond market and allocated into equities, which is exactly what's going on and keeps that equity market growing, there's suddenly that cyclical data actually starts to falter at exactly the point that you have much tighter financial conditions. Now, you could say, oh, well, the Fed will just ease, but might not be so easy for them to do that, or the ECB, because then maybe we're actually starting to see secondary inflationary pressures. And I just showed you it's happening in wages. It seems to be happening in some of the PMI data, according to at least some of the market surveys. So imagine a situation where the equity market actually starts to falter, but you have this backdrop of strong inflation. That, I actually think, is by far the most dangerous scenario that we've faced since the GFC. So it's not that I would say I'm a rampant bull. I think it's just a question of how you can potentially get to that tipping point. It's, for me, it's not via weakness. That tipping point potentially comes via strength.
So economic strength is actually the risk factor that could start off what essentially becomes a self-reinforcing process in the equity market to unwind what has happened.
I think so, Eric, and very simply because I think, you know, and this is odd, you know, I've had conversations with clients and they said, but Julian, you know, this is what we want. We want growth and inflation, don't we? And I said, of course we do. But unfortunately, thanks to these asinine policies of these academics, we've created market extremes within the adjustment process. You know, we pushed bond yields to the floor. We nailed equity prices to the ceiling. In that adjustment process, do you create so much friction that you just tip them over? And that's my fear. That is my fear.
Okay, I think we left off around page 14 or 15 of your slide deck where you started to get into the U.S. dollar. What can you tell us there?
So, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, we've been bullish on the dollar for the last sort of 2 to 3 months. And we said, you know, essentially, as I said, if you go back and look at that very first slide that you get this big run up in the dollar, 20, 25%. You get this emerging market crisis. You see, then see this pause in the dollar and a dip. But because you kick off this reflationary cycle, at some point, the Fed is forced to hike again. And as they hike, the dollar starts to break out. And the very fact of the matter is, Eric, this is perfectly normal. So our point has been that this movement in the dollar, this rise in the dollar, yes, it's been accelerated by the Trump story, but is a perfectly normal cyclical story. It's 100% supported by the fundamentals. And if you look at the slide here, we've got, say, the euro, and we've put in the interest rate differential between 10-year treasuries and 10-year bunds, and we've just inverted it. And you can see there's no major divergence here. You know, FX is trading fully in line with the interest rate differential. This is quite normal. This is just a cyclical move. There's nothing abnormal at this point. Where things start to get interesting, I think, and could truly get disruptive is when we contemplate the prospects of this corporate repatriation package, which is certainly on Donald Trump's agenda. And one of the things that we've discussed with clients is what happens, not only in terms of the price of the dollar, but actually in terms of dollar funding. So if you look at the price, I think a decent indication of what could happen is what happened in the past when we did a repatriation deal. The last one we did was in, it was enacted at the end of 2004 and ran into 2005, and it was called the Homeland Investment Act. And the vast majority of the money, I think it was about $360 billion in total that was repatriated, 300 of that, it happened in 2005. And if you look at the price action of the dollar, if you pull up the chart from the beginning of January of 2005, you'll see virtually the first trading day of the year, this thing goes straight up. And remember, this was happening in a period where essentially from 2002 all the way into the GFC in 2008, the dollar was just inexorably declining. So the one positive year we get is when we get this Homeland Investment Act. And so I think we're looking at that sort of prospect when this thing is enacted. Now we're talking end of 2017 when the legislation probably gets passed in sort of September, October for 2018. But I think this is a big risk because we've already got a strong dollar. But the biggest risk actually is to me is not the price of the dollar, and that is it's the supply of dollars. And we've shown you this chart before, but let me run through this because just like the first chart that we showed, this to me is a fundamentally important thesis that your clients need to understand. Now, just take a step back. What is the role of the reserve provider in a reserve currency system? Well, he gets lots of benefits. He gets seigniorage, he gets cheap funding, but he really has only one single objective, and that is basically to supply sufficient reserves to the rest of the world to enable them to grow. So if you are India growing at 5% per annum, You need 5% more dollars to buy 5% more oil, 5% more copper to fuel that growth. Where do you get them? You get them sustainably from the current account deficit of the reserve provider. And that is actually typically why reserve systems end up collapsing, because it's quite encouraging as the reserve provider, where you've got very low rates subsidized by the rest of the world, to be actually become overly profligate, to run excessively large fiscal deficits, to run excessively large current account deficits. And the whole system typically collapses when your creditors turn around and go, you're not going to be able to pay us back, are you? And, you know, this classic example being France during the Bretton Woods system, which actually led to the collapse of Bretton Woods system. So, as we discussed, you know, Vietnam War, we're pumping out money. And the French go, give us our gold back out of Fort Knox. And the system collapses. And that point is actually called, there's an economic term for it, called Triffin's dilemma. And Triffin's dilemma is essentially a point where the policies you're running domestically are incompatible with the policies you should be running as the reserve provider. And what's interesting is that that's typically because you're over profligate. Now, there are examples where you actually have Triffin's dilemma, but it's the other way around. You're not providing the world with enough reserves. So if you look at this chart here, you'll see I've highlighted two previous occasions. So when Volcker came in, we've got high inflation, he comes in and he puts the screws to the US economy. The US current account deficit shrinks as a result, and it drops woefully below the level necessary to support global GDP growth. What happens is the dollar explodes higher and we burst the Latin American debt bubble and commodity bubble, and we get a big EM crisis. The same thing happened at the end of the 80s, where the Fed over-tightened, inadvertently crashing the housing market. The first thing that bursts is the Nikkei bubble. The second thing that bursts is the Asian bubble. But the point to note here, Eric, is that the Fed really hasn't done much tightening, and yet we have this significant shortfall of the current account deficit. And the reason for that is simply because of oil substitution. We are now no longer importing anywhere close to as much energy as we were, and that is our biggest single element of the current account deficit. So we think that deficit is running at about $400 billion a year. The difference is made up by outflows from the capital account, which we've used the Fed's balance sheet as a proxy. But we all know that that's incredibly fickle. We all have seen how last year suddenly American investors go, let me bring my money home. We all saw in January how when the dollar relaxed, $60 billion floats out of the US, pumps up emerging markets, and then Trump gets elected and the money comes back again. And the reason why we can go from feast to famine in emerging markets in a nanosecond, and within that as well, the commodity space, is because we have this fundamental structural shortfall caused by the collapse of the current account deficit. And I'm very much afraid that because we've seen some quite significant changes to the plumbing of the process by which dollars in the United States get rehypothecated, or should we say flow back out to overseas, because we've seen significant changes, most notably in money market regulations and because of Basel III, that if you take that money that is sitting in corporate bank accounts in, say, Geneva, even if it's in dollars, and you bring it back to New York, once again in dollars, just the changes to the plumbing mean that those dollars will not be able to fund overseas dollar liabilities. And with this structural backdrop problem that we have because of this current account shortfall, we will just get this explosive dollar rally, and we will get a massive dollar funding problem, the like of which we probably didn't see in EM since 98.
Now, one of Triffin's predictions, I'm a huge fan of Robert Triffin, was that eventually, long-term, the U.S. would lose its reserve currency issuance status because of all of the overspending and things that it was able to do as a result of having that status. And some people thought in the 70s that that was happening, and of course it didn't. A lot of people mm-hmm. think the petrodollar system is what saved it. Well, now, of course, the petrodollar system is under question because, as you say, we're not importing as much oil. So do you think that Triffin Triffin's ultimate prediction of the dollar losing reserve currency status is getting closer? Is that on the horizon, or is that still distant future?
I think we could get quite, if I'm right, sometime in sort of 2019, I think that debate, because remember, the repatriation probably kicks off really heavily in 2018. I think that is going to be a question that is on everyone's lips. Ironically, not because we're being over profligate and supplying the world with too many reserves, but because we're not supplying the world with enough. And I think that, you know, third time major, or fourth time possibly at that point, major emerging market crisis, people may well turn around and say, whoa, 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 we have to actually come up with an alternative. And I think it'll be, you know, at a time when you're moving to greater to sort of insularism in what I would call sort of economic nationalism, which I think is the main cause of what you see behind Brexit and what you see behind President Trump's election. I think those factors come into play, because at that point the US should step up and say, okay, fine, we can come up with some sort of, you know, massive amorphous pool of dollars that we can lend to everyone. But I'm just not sure that an increasingly insular Trump administration is going to want to do that. So I think that's when you could see some sort of alternative. Now, what does it get based around? Probably has to be some sort of synthetic currency, like an SDR, because the Chinese, to be a reserve provider, you have to run a deficit. And I'm just not sure who's going to be running that deficit.
Well, if that were to occur, if the world started looking for an alternative to dollars as reserve assets for the reason, as you described, that the U.S. is not able to provide enough to meet demand, does that result in kind of a blow-off top in the dollar at some point, where suddenly as a viable alternative emerges, maybe it's some combination of an SDR or China? You know, there's been talk supposedly about China and Russia asserting a new gold-backed currency. I think that's a lot more hype than reality. But if something like this were to occur, does it eventually lead to a crash in the U.S. Treasury bond market? Because everybody says, hey, these guys can't repay this money. These yields are ridiculous. Ridiculously low, and we've got an alternative suddenly. Does that result in a major sell-off, or do you think the demand for dollars continues because it stays a desirable reserve asset, even if not the only one?
Right. I mean, you're talking a long way out here, and a lot of things could be happening. I think it does create risks to treasuries. I mean, I think we're seeing that potential risk now. I mean, I think if we become more insular, when you stop running a large current account deficit, then essentially, and you're causing through that dollar strength to cause a lot of your reserve holders to already draw down on their reserves and sell dollar assets. So you're already putting a lot more emphasis on US domestics funding their own deficits. And I mean, you know, if you ask domestics, you know, just to fund the government deficit, you know, what would be treasury yields? And I'm going to say that's where you get your Grundlag 6%, right? That's how you do it. I do think, though, the reality of the situation is when you reach that crunch point, if the US doesn't step up to the plate, the US would play very hard to ensure that whatever new system we got, some sort of basket currency, that the US dollar played a very dominant part, perhaps not and almost certainly the dominant part. But there's a lot of moving parts when you get out to that point, Eric. But I think the fundamental point that your clients need to understand is that as things stand at the moment, given this structural hole caused by the relative collapse of the US current account deficit, which isn't going to close anytime soon. It's closed slowly, but it won't close anytime soon, particularly with Trump's policies, that we have this structural instability at the heart of the reserve system. And it means that you do anything to start playing with those capital flows, for example, this corporate tax repatriation deal, or even just making rates in the US just go up, you know, relative to the rest of the world, then you create massive instant instability.
Julian, I would love to continue this for another hour, but unfortunately we are up against our time limit. So I'm going to have to shift gears here and ask you first, for our institutional listeners who are able to consider your institutional advisory product, what do you do over at MI2?
So MI2 has been going just over 5 years now. We were sort of launched by some of our clients who became clients who'd sort of, I was sitting on a bank trading desk and they sort of asked me to start to go independent. And we've continued to grow sort of organically since then. We basically provide the sort of stuff that you've got here in front of you. That's the sort of stuff that I primarily have focused on. This sort of structural, bigger picture sort of theme stories to help tee up major changes in the market. Bond market move being probably the most recent example, or the dollar move that we're in the process of seeing. And then we have, in addition to that, we have this adjunct product, which we call MI2 Trader. And that is very much designed, Eric, to sort of say, right, we've been talking about bond yields rising. Here's the level that you've got to watch on, say, 30-year treasuries, and it's now that you pull the trigger. And then we also have a slightly different product called the Japan Update, which is just basically written by one of our colleagues who's got 35 years trading Japanese equities. He's beyond fluent speaker of Japanese. And that's also, clients love that because we launched that in 2012 where there was really no Japanese research around. So we've kind of got these sort of three core elements of the institutional product. And that's what we do at the moment.
And those are all institutionally priced products that are probably out of reach to our retail audience component. Mm-hmm. For the retail audience, you have been very prolific on Real Vision Television. I know that you were featured in their Donald Trump special, and you have some great content there, which I think that's actually, even if you're not a Real Vision subscriber, they've got that one up for free at realvisiontv.com. But I've also heard a rumor, Julian, that you may have something in the works that may make some of your services more available to the retail component of the audience. Can you tell us anything about what might be coming?
Blimey. Eric, your antenna are good. We're working on something. We're working on something. Early next year, we hope to have something which is more orientated to what I would call the active retail client base. We're definitely working on something. Wow. Quite impressed with that intelligence.
I have sources in the industry. That gives me an excuse to get you back on the program sooner rather than later. So thank you again so much for a fantastic interview. We are running a little bit over time, actually, so I'm going to have to end it there. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Wow, Julian Brigden is awesome, and I always come away learning something new from his interview appearances. So, on last week's show, Eric, you also asked me to reach out to Raoul Powell for an update on his view on Treasury yields. Well, Raoul joins us now from Real Vision headquarters in the Cayman Islands. Off to you, Eric.
Raoul Paul, thank you so much for coming back on the program. I have been dying for an update. Last time that we interviewed you at full length on the program, you had brilliantly closed out your long positions on bonds back, I think, in June or so, because you saw this backup in rates coming. But when we spoke, and of course that was before the presidential election victory of Donald Trump, your view was that this was going to create a buying opportunity as we got between 2.25% and 2.5%, I think, was what you predicted. Sure enough, we're there. You said it was going to be time to buy because sub 1% rates were still coming in a recession scenario. Now we've got, of course, a totally different backdrop and landscape. Does it change your view, or do you still think that we're headed for lower yields?
Nice question. That's not an easy one to answer, because the problem is we're dealing with things that we don't know. So the market's extrapolating a future growth path out of the Trump presidency. Now, we have no idea what policies he's going to manage to implement, the success of those policies, whether they end up like Abe policies that didn't really do anything. You know, we don't really know what's coming. So it's difficult to really make an assessment about the future. You know, as I've noted in the past, if we look at every two-term presidential election after a two-term incumbent has changed, there has been a recession every single time going back to 1910. So the probabilities of a slowdown caused by the changes in the presidential cycle are meaningful. And as I've spoken about in the past, you know, the economy was slowing down. we got to a point last year, where growth got down to zero again, but we don't get that recession. We saw recessions in almost all indicators, nothing really happened. So the question is what's going to happen in 2017? The markets are now extrapolating something wildly different, but it makes it very difficult for the bond market call. You know, we're at the level we should be starting to assess. We note that kind of the bond yields have never, let's say 10-year bond yields, have never backed up beyond the previous backup, if that makes any sense. So the previous backups occurred when it went to 3% yield. I think that was the taper tantrum. And so therefore, unless the bond market goes beyond 3%, we can't say anything's changed. If it did, it'll be the first time it's done that pretty much in the entire history of the bond bull market, in which case maybe something has dramatically changed. The market narrative is that everything has changed, but I'm not sure that's the case. Knowing the demographic backdrop, the slow inflation, the impossibility of generating inflation, I'm just not sure it's there. Also, we've got to note the dollar is screaming higher, something that I've been talking about for a few years now. That's wildly deflationary. So I'm not sure the market's not going to be wrong-footed in this, which is why I'm still interested in the idea of buying bonds. But I'm looking for that right entry, looking for the bond market to do something that is not expected now. Also looking for the economy to start showing signs that things are not as people perceive it to be. So it's really about that. Now, the kind of reflexivity story would be equities and everything else are creating now a more positive economic backdrop. Maybe something does change. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is the outlier where suddenly we don't get a recession in the first term or the first year of a new president. We don't know. We just have to wait and see. So I wish I could be more specific on it, but there's times when you have to just sit and assess, and I'm still in the assessing point.
You said that you were looking for an opportunity to buy bonds. Is there a particular signal that would cause you to take that action?
Yeah, I think firstly I want to see how they trade as they get towards 3%. So we're at 2.6% today in the 10-year bond. Let's see what happens with stronger data. Let's see what happens once equities start correcting. They will do at some point. You can't just keep going up in a straight line. Let's see what the dollar does in terms of translation effects, in terms of inflation. Let's see if it affects the oil markets at some point. So there's a whole number of things we need to look at, and we can't just isolate the bond market itself. We need to look at the overall picture. But I'm really looking to see the bond market starting to run out of steam at some point, and where they've priced in so much economic growth that things have changed. Basically, for the bond market to be right now, you're starting to see a longer-term pickup in nominal GDP. Now, is that possible? Yes. Is it probable? I don't really know yet. So, yeah, again, I wish I could be clearer, but sometimes, you know, you can't just bet your life on it and say, yeah, it's going to do this. We have to wait and see. But I think I'm looking for that yield to top out. If it breaks 3%, then my mind changes, and I think something has changed overall.
I want to go back to our last interview again, because I tried to set you up at the end to talk about a new business venture that you guys are doing, and I love the disruptive approach that you take to finance. You wouldn't talk at the time. So are we ready to go public with Real Vision Publications now?
Yeah, we are, Eric. I mean, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about this, because we're doing something which is really, again, breaking the mold. We're getting rid of the bad parts of the financial media and showing the way forward, how things should really be done. And the newsletter industry and the research industry has got two main problems. One is on the research side, the more in-depth research side, the kind of stuff that I do, it's not available to the average guy. It's very expensive. The people who write that research aren't well known to the general public. They're well known within the industry. But people don't get the chance of that. And we firmly believe at Real Vision in the democratization of financial information. It's really important that the average guy gets high-quality research. And that leads me on to the second point, the newsletters. Most of the average investors, they get newsletters from kind of well-known names. Most of these names have never managed money before. They're not really well-respected in the professional arena, but they are in the newsletter arena. Now, the problem is the quality of the research is generally pretty low, and the marketing is so aggressive. It's spam. It's sensationalism. It's the world's going to end. Buy gold, buy this newsletter. And I just think people deserve more, much like we did with financial television, where we saw the incumbents in the financial television industry basically treating finance as entertainment. This is people's life savings. It really matters. And you can't treat it so flippantly. You can't just have 3-minute sound bites. And it's the same in the research world. So we built something called Real Vision Publications that takes that all on. what you're going to get is you're going to get 30 of the world's greatest research writers, be they newsletter writers or high-end writers such as Julian Brigden. Nowhere in the world do you get that spread of things together, of writers together, and you get a much broader base of information than you ordinarily would out of a standard newsletter writer writing generally about the end of the world and buy gold. So, you know, we are doing something really important. I think it'll set the entire benchmark for the industry. We've developed a stunning platform, much like we did with Real Vision Television. We've built the world's most beautiful research publications platform as well. So we're super excited about it.
It sounds fantastic. I have to tell you, I have one point of skepticism, which is I've seen the list, and you are not aiming for the bottom. You are definitely looking at some top people in the industry. But you take a Julian Brigden, who we just interviewed on today's show. His institutional advisory service, I think it's about $30,000 a year. Stephanie Pomboy, who's also on your list, is in the same approximate price range, as is your global macro investor. I think you've got Jonathan Tepper on your list. I believe he's a $50,000 subscription. So I'm sitting down, Raul. I'm assuming this thing costs a lot more than Real Vision Television at $365 a year. How much is it? Because you're tapping into some very expensive services here.
Yeah, you know, we are. You know, this is going to be the creme de la creme of services. And for that, you're going to pay a massive $200 a year. Well, that's the introductory rate anyway.
$200, and that's I don't get it. How do you get access to people who sell their services for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year at that price?
Well, you know, the people, like with Real Vision Television, they believe in our message. Now, it's good for them because we're not giving all of their research away. So you're not getting 30 research writers every single piece. You're getting examples of, but it's timely examples. You get over 104, I think, pieces of research a year. So that's two a week of all of these incredible list of writers. And basically, they believe in what we're doing. They believe in the democratization of financial information. And so they've come with us on this journey. And we hope a group of people come with us on this journey too, in terms of, you know, consuming this research, because we really think we're setting the benchmark.
And we've got a link in our Research Roundup email that we've sent our subscribed users to a video that you and your partner, Grant Williams, produced, describing in more detail what Real Vision Publications is all about, what you get, and so forth. But I want to move on, because I know you've got yet another disruptive business plan that you're planning to launch next month. Tell us about that one.
No.
No?
I'm going to give you the scoop. You're going to get the scoop. I promise you the scoop. But right now, I can't reveal it, but it's another really exciting thing where we've got huge ambitions and we just want to change again the benchmark of which everything is judged. So you'll hear about it. As soon as it comes, you'll be the first guy to know. I promise you.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're not going to give it to us this time and we have to wait till next month, I want another full-length interview out of it before we're going to get you back on with another promotional opportunity. So let's get you booked for a full-length interview. When's good for you? Sometime in January?
Yeah, I think later in Jan will be perfect. Also, hopefully by then I've got some stronger views, because I don't have that many strong views right now because of the problem of the narrative versus the reality. So I'd like to come back and add some value when I do.
I want to go through everything we talked about in your last interview, from precious metals to bond yields to equities, because I think that it is all changing dramatically. And like you, I haven't quite figured out yet precisely how it's changing. So let's revisit that towards the second half of January. And thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Eric. And have a great, great holiday.
I sure will. You too.
Thanks, guys. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but Eric, anything else you'd like to add?
This will be our last regular format episode for 2016. So I'd like to thank all of you listeners for listening, and we sure would appreciate your help in spreading the word about the show. But it's not over yet. Over the holidays, we have a whole bunch of exciting content planned for you. It is all pre-recorded, so it will not include up-to-the-minute market information. But December 22nd, next Thursday, we're going to air part 3 of my Accredited Investor Academy series. That's all about alternative investments, which is venture capital and hedge funds and private equity and so forth. We're going to talk about their fee structures, their legal structure, the basis in the Investment Act of 1940 for how they get around the rules and regulations that apply to regular investment funds. That's coming up next Thursday. Next Friday, December 23rd, we're going to air part 3A of the Accredited Investor Academy. That's actually essentially a rerun of my interview with David Rose back several months ago here on the program. And then on the 24th, we're going to have, again, a Real Vision special rebroadcast. They're promoting their new Real Vision Publications business that Raul told us about. So I think they're probably going to send us some pretty good content, so you're not going to want to miss that on Christmas Eve. Then the following Thursday, December 29th, we're going to bring you part four, the final chapter of my Accredited Investor Academy, and then yet another Real Vision rebroadcast on the 30th. So you've got a whole bunch of content coming up over the holiday weekends. And of course, as I've said many times before, we really need your help promoting the show, folks. If you would retweet us when you see us announce the program, and most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com, especially you accredited investors, because the statistic of how many users we have registered, and particularly how many accredited investors we have registered, that's what Aaron uses in order to persuade the most interesting and desirable guests that it's worth their time to come on this program and give us a full-length feature interview, as we got from Julian Brigden this week. The benefit to you is that you'll automatically receive our research roundup email, which gives you links to things like the download for Julian's presentation, so you don't have to go digging for it, as well as all of the very best content that Aaron could find around the internet every single week. Aaron, what have we got in this week's research roundup?
Well, this week we got the latest slide deck from Jeff Gundlach's monthly webcast. This presentation is entitled Drain the Swamp and is a must-read every month it comes out. Next, there's Hugh Hendry's latest investment letter and market commentary. And finally, for those of you who are not yet Real Vision subscribers, there's a link to clips of the top interviews of 2016 that you should definitely check out. You'll find all this and much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our ProFinance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at MacroDidact. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Happy holidays and have a happy new year.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.